Elementary music teacher friend, you love what you do, but you might feel unappreciated and, in fact, unseen some days. You may even feel like you're on a music teacher island and just want to connect with other music teachers who can relate to both your struggles and wins when it comes to teaching elementary music. I get you and understand completely the feelings you're having. That's why each and every week, the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast will provide you with solo and guest episodes that will help you realize you're not alone in your music teaching journey. Throughout each episode, my goal is for you to be able to walk away with actionable steps and ideas to help you feel like you're ready to take on the new week with whatever challenges may be thrown your way. Hi, I'm your host, Jessica Paresta, and I'm so glad you're here. Whether you're at home, in your car, in the shower, or wherever else you're listening, grab your cup of coffee or whatever other beverage is nearby and listen in to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. I am beyond thrilled to be joined today by Robert France, who is a conductor and music director of the Windsor Symphony Orchestra. He has created content for family audiences and in-school concerts and loves to talk about active listening for kids when it comes to music. In fact, he created a 5-part series called Stella's Magical Musical Balloon Ride. And I love this conversation, especially during the time we're living in right now where kiddos can't really go to live concerts and performances as much as they used to. But also, while you're teaching in school, you may want to bring live experiences to your students or to bring them to live experiences, and you may not have the funds to be able to do that or the means to be able to do that. So he talks about how to bring live experiences to your students, even if they're not able to get out and go somewhere. I love this conversation. So he talks about being a director and his heart for helping family audiences and wanting to work with schools and how that all came about, and then ways that kids can actively listen to music. And he presents it in a way I have not really ever heard anybody talk about it before. And it's so neat hearing his perspective. But you can find out more about Robert France and all of his conducting experiences and all of the amazing work he's doing. And it's just so incredible to have him on here to be able to talk to a real life conductor and director of music. And you can check him out at robertfrance.com. That's FRANZ. But I will give you more information about him at the end of this episode. And you can also check out the show notes for more information about him and a link to the YouTube video series that I just mentioned earlier. So let's go ahead and get started. And I cannot wait for you to listen to this conversation that was so refreshing and so needed. And I am just so excited to have this episode on the podcast. Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. You are in for a treat today. I'm super excited to be joined by Robert France. He is a conductor and has so much awesome knowledge to share with us about bringing music to kiddos in a different way than you're used to thinking about as a music teacher. So we're just going to have some really, really fun conversations today, and I cannot wait for you guys to learn from him and to hear his story and, all the things. So, Robert, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really thrilled to be here.
So why don't you just start out by telling us just a little bit about yourself? How did you become a conductor? Growing up, was music something that you just really enjoyed and that spoke to you, and all those things you could relay to our listeners today?
So what's really interesting is that I actually grew up in a household. We had music. It wasn't that it wasn't a non-musical household, but my dad played guitar. He sang a couple of songs, but it wasn't a classical music household at all, like not even close. And so in third grade, the music teacher, her name was Willa Losher. She came around and she said, "Hey, do you want to play an instrument?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. Everybody else is." And she said, "Well, you want to play?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Well, let me see your hands." So she held up my hands. She goes, "Oh, these are the hands of a great cellist." And I was like, "Oh, well, that's cool." So I'm looking at my hands thinking, And so I went home and I said to my parents, "Look at my hands. They're the hands of a great cellist." And they said, "Well, what does that mean?" And I said, "I have no idea." So what happened was My hands were big enough to hold a cello, which is why I didn't get assigned the violin. That's basically what occurred. But in the fall, when I went to back to school and got my instrument, she taught me how to make a sound on the instrument. And I took it home for 4 hours. I sat there and just made sounds. And when I was done, I went downstairs to my parents and I said, I'm going to be a musician for the rest of my life. This is it. To which they replied, of course, that's cute, right? Because that's, you know. But, you know, when looking back, Willa was a special, special human being. First of all, she was a professional musician who also taught elementary school. So she had her feet in two different pools. And looking back, the kind of stuff that she had us do at first and second year students was really extraordinary. You know, excerpts from Brahms' First Symphony, all sorts of really incredible music that looking, you know, I think to myself, wow, she was really reaching for the stars with us. And I really appreciated that. And so that I went to a public school. This was totally unexpected. It was just the luck of the draw. And I think that to me is one of the most important valuable lessons I've had in my life, is that you never know when you can change a child's life in a sort of have a major impact in their life. And in 25 years later, I went back to Willa, found her. She and I get together every once in a while and go to concerts together in the summer, festivals and whatnot. And it has been so much fun reconnecting with her as an adult and kind of seeing sort of how she thinks from an adult perspective. So that's how it started. That's how I got involved. But eventually we moved to a place where there were no strings in the schools. And so I switched to oboe, not by choice. Just the band teacher said, hey, there's an oboe in the closet. Nobody wants to play. You want to play it? I thought it was the bassoon. And I was like, yeah, that'd be cool. And then he handed me the oboe. And I was like, this is not cool. But eventually I got better at it, and I eventually went to the North Carolina School of the Arts and got a bachelor's degree in oboe. Halfway through.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was funny too, because I said to my parents, I said, I'm going to music school, and they're like, that's great, what are you doing for a living?
Oh, said, man, yes.
Right? Yes. And so I said, well, I think I'll figure it out. You know, I always had this sort of like inside of me, I'm always like, okay, look, you know what, this is what I want to do. I'll figure it out. I mean, how hard can it be, right? And you don't know the answer to that question. It's a great freedom. So halfway through undergrad, I decided to take a conducting class just to see what it was like. And I remember the very first day that I stood in front of the orchestra and I raised my hand, and my hand came back down and sound came out. And I thought, this is it. This is exactly what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And so it chose me, really. Like once I did it, there was no choice. I was driven. So I ended up staying at the School of the Arts and doing a master's degree in conducting. I graduated with those two degrees, and I had no hope of getting a job, because in order to get a job, you have to have experience. Right? Get experience, you have to have a job. So I thought, well, I'll just start my own orchestra. I mean, how hard can it be? And so, again, not knowing the answer to that question, I just did it. So I raised money. I did everything. And I had an orchestra called the Carolina Chamber Symphony, which I started. I also had 7 part-time jobs so that I could eat and, you know, do what I needed to do. And over the course of the years, eventually I kept applying, and eventually I got an audition and I won an audition. And my first job was as assistant conductor of the Louisville Orchestra. And then it sort of transferred to where I am today. And so today I'm the associate conductor of the Houston Symphony, where I do education concerts and family concerts. I'm the music director of the Windsor Symphony in Ontario in Canada. And I'm the artistic director of the Boise Baroque Orchestra. So I sort of have my feet in 3 different camps, which I think is really important, because it really enables me to get different perspectives in all sorts of areas, and to be able to share those perspectives between them.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. There's so much there I can unpack. I love everything you said. I can relate to your story about having a teacher that inspired you. And I'm big on this podcast, or with just working with teachers in general, letting them know, you never know what student's life you are, you know, planting a seed in. You really don't.
Important? Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what's important about that. Mm-hmm. It's not that you can go out and say, I want to be an inspiration to this kid.
Yep.
It's with Willa, it's because of the way she was, who she was as an artist and as a person, that I was inspired.
Yes.
If you can't control it, you have to be that person.
Yeah, you be you, and you never know what student is going to connect with that. It's so true. Oh man, no, that's so. Starting piano for me was my first grade homeroom teacher. It wasn't even a music teacher, and she had a piano in her classroom. Just played it for our class. Wasn't playing it to teach us anything.
And I went home and picked out the melody of Jolly Old St. Nicholas. And my mom looked at me like, what? Did somebody teach you that? I'm like, no, I just heard her play it, you know, and I was behind the upright piano.
Yeah.
Like, what? So same thing. But yeah, when I said I'm going to do music as a career and I'm going to college, I started as a piano performance major. Same thing. Comments from people. What are you going to do with that? What do you mean? Yeah. How are you going to? But I love what you said too about you love that you have different experiences and have your foot in different doors. Because I think that's so important. And I think it's so important too that music teachers stay musicians as well in one avenue or another, because your musicianship is what makes you, I feel like, the person you are and what has helped shape you as a teacher. And so I've tried to keep my foot in the accompanist door and the private lesson door. And then, you know, being in the classroom and now I'm helping music teachers, but I feel like as musicians, it's hard to just make a decision about, I want to do this one thing. But don't you feel like that's what's cool about being a musician is you don't have to just choose one. You can be multi, you know, interested in things, I guess is that the phrase I'm looking for?
That's well, yeah. I mean, I get it exactly that like there's so many things can be an inspiration. They can sort of feed each other. But I think this point you make is really vital. Mm. I think if you're going to be a music teacher and you're teaching an art form to a student, that you must be a practitioner of that art form. You must have some artistic outlet. You must not lose the connection to the art, the act of making art.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably where a lot of the burnout comes from too. Because we, you know, self-care can look, you know, like reading a book, going for a walk, but also taking care of your musician self too, I think is so important. So yeah, I love that. Okay. So you've mentioned you've created content for family audiences and you do in-school concerts. So I would just love for you to just talk about that and what it's like and what do you do with that?
So I'll tell you where it started. After I got out of college and I did a couple of years of rural residency programs, 1 year in Kansas, 1 year in Southern Georgia, I moved back to North Carolina where I had been a student. And I became involved with the Winston-Salem Symphony's Bolton Project. The Bolton Project was a project that put a woodwind quintet, I was the oboist in the quintet, in residence in an elementary school that was at risk. And it was a research project. The question was, if we integrate music into the curriculum without kids playing instruments. So we weren't going to teach instruments. We were using music as music, just pure music. Could we affect test scores? And I was invited to be the sort of music master. I was the one who helped create the programs with the teachers and kind of build these interdisciplinary programs. So we worked with our kids. This school was 44% of the kids were passing the state standardized test. We worked with our kids for 3 years. The end of the 3 years, it shot up to 88% of the kids passing the state standardized test. So because we were musicians and not scientists, we brought in someone from the Bowman Gray School of Medicine to sort of assess what we had done neurologically. And what he discovered is that what we had done is that we had developed high-level active listening skills. Mm. And it turns out that active listening is one of the keys to being a good reader. And so without knowing it exactly, we had developed their ability to read at grade levels, usually 1, 2, or 3 above their actual grade level. And as you know, as anybody knows, once a child is comfortable and enjoys and is good at reading, then the world is their oyster. I mean, everything's out in front of them. So that was one aspect of it. The second aspect of it was at the end of the third year, we had 300 6, 7, and 8-year-olds in the gymnasium, the gymatorium. And we performed a 1-hour woodwind quintet concert with 3 20-minute pieces, not something you would normally perform at an elementary school. Mm-hmm. Our kids were so invested. They knew how to listen. They knew what to listen for. They were connected. And it was a magical experience for them and for us. It's an experience I'll never forget. Mm-hmm. So ever since then, this was decades ago now, ever since then, I have created education concerts that focus on one thing and one thing only, and that's the art of active listening. Mm-hmm. How do I help develop those skills for a young listener to actively listen? So for instance, I don't approach music in the way that sometimes people do, which is to say, okay, I want you to listen to this piece and I want you to tell me how it makes you feel. Does it make you feel sad or happy? I do it a little bit more, specific. What kind of sounds do you hear? Do you hear high sounds, low sounds, middle sounds? Do you hear fast sounds, slow sounds? Do you hear layers? Which layers are doing which kind of activities? Really sort of analyzing what the sound world is that they're in with this piece of music. Mm-hmm. And what I find with that is that when a young listener or a listener of any age does that, goes through that process, that they all of a sudden at the end of it have a much deeper and more profound, not only acceptance, but understanding and interest in that piece of music. And mm-hmm. so while it's not that sort of, ooh, I like this or I don't like this kind of initial reaction, it's always a deeper, more profound reaction. So my role as assistant conductor or conductor, wherever I conduct and make music for kids, is that I have thousands of kids who come into the hall. I have 45 minutes to an hour, and I have an incredible tool in front of me. I have a symphony orchestra. And so what I do is I say to myself, okay, if I want them to hear this one piece of music really intensely and really well, what elements are necessary? And so I'll start with that piece, and then I'll build myself backwards, all of the elements, and I'll pick pieces that hit all of these elements, so that when we get to that final piece, they are listening and thinking in a very intensive and clear way about that piece of music. Mm-hmm. And that's really been, that's been the system, that's been the magic ever since I started this. And I've done concerts for 70, 80,000 kids a year. Wow. Over the last few decades. So it's been a real, not only labor of love, but it's been a real wonderful experiment in understanding the power of music and understanding what it can do. And that doesn't even touch on the fact that all that work, in addition, I'm sure has inspired many, many, many kids over the years to mm-hmm. want to be musicians themselves.
Oh, but for you see, sure.
But yeah. The goal isn't like, come in so that we can show you how great it is to be a musician. The goal is come in so you can engage with classical music and see how mm-hmm. fun it is. Mm-hmm. And then they go away and they make the decision to play an instrument.
Mm. It goes back to that planting the seed that we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And love being that. Who we are. Mm-hmm. Jessica, that's so important. Like being like, you know, I remember having a conversation with teachers years ago about a space concert I was doing. It was all music from the planets. And they said,
how fun.
Yeah. And they said, you really need to do music from Star Wars. And I said, I'm not going to do music from Star Wars. And they said, no, you really do, because then the kids will know it and they'll love it, you know. And I said, the fact that they know it is actually the reason I don't want to do it. Mm. I want them to hear music that they don't know so they can experience it fresh and understand it. And then they can go back and enjoy Star Wars or whatever they want. But the Star Wars gets in the way, because the minute you play Star Wars music, kids are thinking Luke Skywalker and lightsabers, right. And they're not thinking, what sounds am I hearing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And in that line, for my education programs, I always use visual aids to get kids connected to the piece, but during the piece of music, it's always just listening. And I've had people say to me, how can you ask kids to sit for 7 minutes and listen? I said, well, you teach them how to listen, and then mm-hmm. you sit there, and then you do it, right? And I've also had the experience where, you know, some people say, oh, when you have a kids concert, they have to get up and dance because they get the wiggles. Well, I've said to kids, okay, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to dance as wildly as you can on the inside. Mm. And they will sit there and you can just see them vibrating on the inside, just moving. And then they understand, by the way, that there's a difference between internalization and externalization. And once they start internalizing that energy and that thought and that excitement, then when they experience music, it's really so much more profound.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I'm going for. I'm going for a profound engagement with music, not so sometimes I hear people go, well, we want to expose kids to classical music. Well, I don't want to expose anybody to anything, quite frankly. What I want to do is I want to engage with them.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and a lot of times it's from no one's fault, but kids have been told classical music is boring.
Yeah.
And it's just, so they have that mindset, not everybody, you know, but some kiddos come and this is boring. I can't listen to it. I can't sit still. It's just instruments. Like you said, where's the music I know? Yeah, and exactly. So helping them, like you said, I want you to touch on that, because you told me, it might've been before we started recording, but some kids you notice will come and you can tell they've been prepared for how to sit still and listen. And then you have some kiddos that come that just, well, I guess can't. So have you noticed that difference, and why do you think that is?
So I notice a huge difference with students who are prepared by their teachers. Not just like the rules, right? Okay, the rules
right.
are like, you know, you don't, I mean, but this is true, by the way, in any group setting. Like, you don't just do whatever you want. There are rules that we mm-hmm. have in society. But more importantly, teachers who've had students listen to the piece already, do some work towards actively listening, ask questions about it, engage with it, means that when the students come to hear it live, all of a sudden it's an incredible experience on top of their preparation. Now, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, we're so busy, we can't prepare them for this or that. But when you think about it, why would you put a child in any situation with any art form or any activity where you don't prepare them first? I mean, in what world is that a good educational model? I don't understand. So with every orchestra I work with, we always send out ahead of time materials to help teachers prepare the students. And it is very super obvious that the ones who are prepared, like they have better questions, they're engaged, they're curious, you know, and the ones that aren't are just like, well, this is kind of interesting, but I don't know what's going on.
Right. Is that an instrument or what do I, is that, you know, a tuba?
I have them for 1 hour a year. So in 1 hour a year, if the teacher doesn't prepare them for that experience, I can only do so much in an hour.
That's true.
I can do a lot if we all work together. And that's what I get particularly excited about.
Yeah. I was thinking too, when you said teaching kids how to feel the music, you know, you don't have to just do it externally. It brought me back to my years of taking piano lessons, even all the way through college, and feel the music. And for a long time, it just didn't click in my brain. What is she talking, or she, or whoever my teacher was at the time?
Yeah.
What are they talking about?
Yeah.
Like, feel music. But it is, it's an internal thing that I think just kids, they just learn it. It just, you know, it takes time. And so letting them know, like, you can feel music in here too. And then eventually, like you said, you would see some of the kiddos, it just kind of started clicking, like, oh, I do feel it in here. It just, you know, it's
right.
Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we talked about active listening, and when it comes to elementary music teachers in their classroom, you talked about doing preparation for coming to the concert and things like that. Are there other ways you encourage or you would encourage teachers on this podcast listening to practice active listening with their students?
I'll tell you, one of the best things I found for creating this sort of environment is doing what I call a soundscape exercise. A soundscape exercise is quite simple. What I do is I stand in front of a group. I ask them for 2 full minutes to sit in complete silence. When we get out of the silence on the other end, I ask them to describe the sounds they heard, with the caveat that they are not allowed to tell me what made the sound or what experience they've had with the sound, just describe the sound. So for instance, they might say, I heard the air conditioner blowing. I'll say, okay, what sound did it make? Was it a sudden sound or a sustained sound? Was it a high pitch or a low pitch? Was it, you know, and I do that a couple of times with a few kids, and then the kids start to get it, and then they start to describe the sound. And then what I can do is I can then insert whatever it is I want them to learn. So a music teacher could insert a piece of music and you could do the exact same question. Or a math teacher could insert a math lesson. And what happens is that all of a sudden I don't know what they're called, but the sort of movement from one side of the brain
right.
to the other. Yeah. Starts like the mind just zaps up. Like it just awakens, and all of a sudden these children are in this place of awareness. And that's really what this is about, is getting everybody together. So one thing that we used to do going into the schools, when the musicians would go into the schools, is they would do the soundscape exercise, but while they did it, they would put their instrument together. And so at the end, they would ask the kids, what sounds did I make while I was putting my instrument together? Short sounds, was it chaotic? Was it a pattern? And that act, and by the way, we did that at the beginning of every single class at the Bolton Project. Every day, 2 minutes, it was what we did. And then we could compare one day to another. And it's really no different than a human being getting up in the morning and saying, okay, I need 2 minutes of my life to just sort of settle in and wake myself up, and then boom, I can go forward, right? And so I think that's key. The second key to me is not being afraid to really sort of explore and engage with classical music. I think there's like this, there are two things. One, there's the, how does the music make me feel? But then there's the second thing, which is music from the inside out is so complicated. Like the theory is complicated, the form and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I always try to pick pieces for kids to listen to that they can engage to from the outside in, that the surface of the music, whatever points I'm trying to make, the surface of the music is pretty clear, right? So I rarely will do a piece that is incredibly esoteric from the inside out, because, you know, at the age of 8, that you're not ready for that. But you could very well take a piece that from the outside in, the surface features are super clear to you. And you're like, oh, there's this and that. And, you know, describing them and actually sort of talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. There's a lot of kids, like you said, they just don't recognize sounds around them. Correct. It's not anybody, like I said earlier, it's no fault of anyone's. But one of my favorite activities to do with kids, even my own children, is to just recognize sounds like when we're on a walk or what sounds do you hear inside? Even like the dishwasher running, for example, it's making sounds. What happens when you shut the door? Is it making rhythms as the water's going? Yes. It can be as simple as that. I mean, it is just a lot of times kids just think of sounds as singing or instruments, but like you said, they don't recognize the other sounds that honestly are the foundations of musical elements involved too. So,
and those two things are intimately connected, right? So they're
completely
the same exact process. And even as adults, it's not just kids, we passively, and we have to do this to maintain our sanity, we passively let millions of sounds just go over us and don't think about them.
Right.
And then we ask people to come into a dark concert hall and listen to an orchestra intensely for an hour. Like, that's a whole different world from where they started. So we have to work to bridge the gap. And that's what the soundscape exercise does.
Yeah, that's amazing. No, I really, really think that's a great point. So I do want to ask you, so kiddos who don't have the opportunity to come to a live performance, whether it's an orchestra concert or any live musical performance for that matter, what ways would you encourage them to still experience music from their homes or at school, ways to introduce them to instruments of the orchestra at school or home too?
I think there are two elements here. One is the act of doing. If you can't go hear an orchestra perform and you can't, you know, you don't have access to that, finding an instrument that you can connect to and make sounds with and play, I think that's like vital. Like, once you have the experience of expressing yourself without words through an instrument, it's like no other mode of communication that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's that. But the second thing is, especially these days, and I would say especially in the period we're in right now, there is so much online content. And, you know, it's funny, my daughters, when they're on their devices all the time, when I ask them to actually look up something that would be useful to them, they all of a sudden get amnesia and have no idea how Google works or how the phone
right
works.
Yes.
But what's funny about that is that if you just type in orchestra or symphony or whatever, millions, they're like, these days, there's no excuse for free content that's online. I mean, it's everywhere. So you have to look for it. You have to want to engage with it. You want to have to try it. And I would say the other thing is, sometimes people, I've had this experience where people have said, oh, I saw this video or I heard this piece, I didn't like it, I don't like classical music. Well, classical music is so broad of a topic. There are literally millions of pieces, thousands of composers. I just, you know, keep exploring, keep experimenting, find things that you connect with. And honestly, Jessica, I don't think that's different from any other activity we do in our life, right? You may say, I tried soccer and I hate it. I hate all sports, right? Like, who says that? Nobody would say that, but you might say that about Bach. And that would be crazy. That just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true. It is. It is. Just goes back to exposing kids to different types of music.
Yeah,
because and engaging
with them. Like, I love the art of engaging. Like, it's interesting. And I know we're gonna talk about this later, but so my daughters and I, we have a great relationship. But what's funny is that, you know, they have their world of like YouTube videos. And so I told them, I said, well, you know, I've been working on my YouTube channel, and I have this many subscribers, and I had this many views this last month. I'm, you know, over 8,000 views last month. And they're like, what? Like, they couldn't, like, it was like, all of a sudden it clicked. Like, are you serious? You had 8,000 views?
Yeah.
8,000.
That's awesome. Yeah. No, they look at, no, I know I have to be better about, I've been better about telling my boys when I'm doing something or explaining my business behind the scenes, because a lot of times they just see my laptop open and they have no idea what's going on. And then I'm like, oh, well, let me explain it to you, because then it kind of brings them into my world and they get a little bit more interested in it too. So yeah, that's so true. I feel like I was going to ask you a question about classical music and it totally left me. So when I think of it, I will definitely go back to that. But let's go ahead and talk about this 5-part series that you told me about. And it sounds so incredible. So I want you to just tell me all about it and the reason you created it and what it is.
So as we talked about earlier, I've been doing these education concerts for years. And one of the education concerts I did was called the Musical Tour of America. And the idea was that I would perform pieces about geographical features like river pieces, mountain pieces, ocean pieces. And in the education concert, we had a big map up hung over the orchestra, and we would fill it in with the features. And so the kids would help me naming the mountains and the rivers, et cetera. Well, I've done that program for years, and I've come up with a list of pieces that I know kids really resonate with, and it connects and it works. I thought about 10, 12 years ago, I thought this would be interesting as a book, if I could tell the story of this and have like kids hear the music that I'm hearing, right? So that coincided with the birth of my first niece. Her name is Stella. And as you know, when you have a first niece in the family, like everybody just goes crazy. And I love her to death. And she is many things. She's precocious. She's smart. She's a cutie patootie, which she hates when I say that. She says, Uncle Bobby, I'm not a patootie. So I had to look that up because I didn't know what a patootie was. Anyway, but now she definitely is a cutie patootie. But she's also a bit of an adventurous spirit, right? She likes to engage with things. And I love that about her. So I thought to myself, what if I wrote a story about Stella engaging in a way that when something happened, she heard this music in her head. And so that's how Stella's magical musical balloon ride came to be. And so the story works like this. Stella gets up one morning, she's set to take this amazing balloon ride. Once she gets up there, she goes over a river that's in her neighborhood, but that she's never saw that way before. And she hears music in her head, the Moldau. Then she goes a little further and she goes over this mountain range, the Rocky Mountains, and she hears Night on Bald Mountain. And then she goes over to the coast and she floats down the beach and she hears music from La Mer, from Debussy's La Mer. And then she comes back around through the desert and she comes up and over the Grand Canyon. And then she returns home. And when she returns home, she realizes that the music that she woke up to that morning in her head was Dvorak's Ninth Symphony. And it has all the same elements as those four pieces. And she hears that in her head. And I, at the time when I wanted to write this book, there wasn't really a technology that made sense. Like I didn't want a kid to open a book and hear a little plasticky kind of sound of a recording, you know? I thought you've got to experience this as a sound world, right? So COVID-19 meant, of course, that I was at home without performing, because I can't perform without an orchestra. Right. And so I started doing some read alouds of books for the Windsor Public Library and the Windsor Symphony, and loved doing that. And it dawned on me that maybe my Stella book would work as a YouTube video. And so I started experimenting with it. And I downloaded Adobe Premiere Pro, and I learned how to use Adobe Premiere Pro. And I created this 5-video series. And it's Stella's Magical Musical Balloon Ride. Part 1, she goes over the river. Part 2, the mountain. Part 3, the ocean. Part 4, the canyon. And part 5, she comes back home. And each video has 3 parts. It has me reading a story. Then it has the music that she hears in her head. And I've superimposed videos of what, flying over a river, so that you can feel like you're flying over the river and hearing the music in her head. And then the third part is I play the music again, but I teach kids how to conduct the music with me. So I give a quick conducting lesson, and then we conduct that piece of music. And each piece of music is it's anywhere from 1 to 2 minutes long, right? So these are bite-sized chunks. So each video is, I forget how long each one is, but they total about 36 minutes for the whole story in 5 parts, and there are 5 of these videos. And that's how Stella's Magical Musical Balloon Ride came to be as a YouTube video. And it's been really first of all, it's gone into a bunch of school systems in Windsor, Essex, in Canada, where I work. And because there's been a lot of at-home learning, teachers have sent these videos one at a time home. And I've heard from not only kids, but parents who are, patrons of ours that said, you came home with my son or my daughter today, and we did Stella's Magical Musical Balloon Ride Part 3. And so it's been really, and I've had some adults say to me, I love conducting the Moldau with you. That's really cool. I didn't know how that worked. And so it's been fun. And so that's how that all came to be.
Yeah. I love that, because kids in music class learn about different musical careers they can have, but just learning about being a conductor, but then being able to be a conductor with you is totally different. It goes back to the learning or listening versus experiencing it. And so I think that's amazing. And kudos to you for doing that. That's awesome.
Thank you. It was a month long project, and it was funny. Mm-hmm. So I had to watch YouTube videos every day to learn how to use Premiere Pro. Right. So I'm every time I come up with a problem, I'd have to go and research it. And the reason I say that is because a couple of days ago, I pulled out a score to start learning it. And I thought, this is the first time I've worked on something where I didn't have to look at a YouTube video first to figure out how it works.
Yes. Isn't it amazing how that works? I know. No, that's anything with technology. People just think you automatically know how to do it. And you're like, no. I spent a lot of hours learning things.
There's one other element to this story that I think is important. And that is that I actually got subtitles to all of the stories going as well, because I call these actually read along, read alouds with Robert, because I think it's important not to just let it wash over you, but to actually read along as it goes along the bottom of the track so that kids are developing those skills. And I actually had a friend in the Middle East who said, my niece is learning English and these books are amazingly helpful to her. Mm. So there are a lot of ways that this can kind of come together.
Yeah, it's so cool. You create something and you don't know how it's going to take shape or form. And then hearing the stories back from people who are viewing your videos or reading your book and coming back to you, you're like, oh, I didn't even realize that could, you know, be influencing you that way.
It's
so cool.
And I'll tell you one other thing, Jessica, that's really important. I got rejection letters from the most famous publishing houses about this book 10 years ago. Like I have a collection of them, right? So I always think to my, and then I put it away. And I wasn't depressed exactly, but I was kind of like, okay, maybe this is not a good idea. And literally it sat on my computer for 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, there it is. And boom.
Yeah.
So I love that too. I mean, kind of like my jobs, I like the idea of if something doesn't fit right now, just set it aside and try something else and just, you know, just keep kind of moving around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just proves you don't give up. Just if you have a dream, you don't know it. I mean, we've talked about planting seeds before, but like even for yourself, you don't know when something is going to transpire for yourself. And, you know, it's about just continuing moving forward, even if you can't see the finish line. And that's so hard to do. It really is. And as a creative person, it's super hard because you want things to happen right now on your timing.
Right.
It's hard to just let things fester and grow on their own timing. So, yeah.
But there is also a side to it that I think is interesting. And I will tell you the other thing about it was that when I was looking at it and sending out to publishers, I did have a little bit of a feeling inside, this isn't quite right yet. Mm. Like it felt like it wasn't quite right yet. I mean, you know, you don't show that or you don't say that because that's not how you get published. But I was like, I'm not sure this feels right. And now looking back, like there's so many other elements that have come into place since then in terms of my ability to write. Like, you know, I've actually taken some writing courses online, right? Like in not thinking about Stella, but just in general, like I've done things that I was like, when I looked at it again, I was like, oh, I could do this way better.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. So where can the listeners find your book? I will link to it in the show notes, but where can they find your book and the YouTube videos?
Super easy. My YouTube page is Robert Franz Conductor, all one word, Robert Franz Conductor. There is another option, which is equally as easy, which is my website, robertfranz.com. And on the education page, there's the button that clicks right to all the read-along, read-alouds.
Awesome. Perfect. I know what I was going to say earlier about classical music. We were talking about kids who maybe don't feel like they can relate to it or it's boring. It's not just about listening to, I've been guilty of this too, playing and say, listen to the song. Did you like it? Without any talking about the composer, why the piece was written, what they were going through when they wrote it. When you bring all these world experiences to the kids about the music they're listening to, it makes it more relevant, and then they understand it a little bit better. So yeah, that's a totally a point I meant to make earlier, and I totally forgot, so I wrote it down so I would be able to say that.
It's a really important point, and it brings to mind the idea of composer's intention, which is something I talk about on stage a lot. And the reason it's so important is because children are learning how to make their intentions clear. It's not just, I want something, so I get it, but you have to make your intention clear. And they have to do that in their writing. And a composer has to do that in their music. They have to make that intention clear.
Yeah, for sure. So Robert, I've loved this conversation. Do you have any other advice for music teachers about anything we talked about or didn't talk about today before we go?
I would just say, for me, the most important thing is that you must feed your soul to feed the soul of others. It has to be that way. There's no way that you can just give and not replenish. And so when I work with music teachers and I see music teachers who are starting to get either tired or exhausted or whatever, I say to myself, you know, the problem here, what I'm missing is that idea of taking care of your artistic needs. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, those are great points. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. This has been an amazing conversation, and I can't wait for the listeners to hear it.
Well, hey there. Thank you so much for listening into the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. There is an exclusive Facebook group just for listeners of this podcast and any elementary music teacher called the Elementary Music Teacher Community Facebook Group. Come on over and join us there, where we have conversations around the podcast episodes and encourage each other each and every week. And also head to my website, thedomesticmusician.com. I have some free resources there that you can download to help you gain traction in your classroom today, as well as the blog and the membership site and all kinds of other goodies to help you keep going in your music teaching journey. I cannot wait to keep connecting with you and encouraging you and spurring you on in your journey of teaching elementary music. Hang in there, have an amazing week, and I will see you soon.